Mrs. Eddy by Hugh Stuttered Kennedy. Chapter 7. Charleston. Charleston, like many other cities in the South, divides its history into three periods: from the earliest times to the Revolutionary War, from the end of that war to the War of 1812, and from the end of the War of 1812 to the outbreak of the great civil conflict in 1861. After that, for many decades, there is no story. In the 40s of last century, Charleston had reached the peak of its third and most brilliant period. The South was still the senior partner in the Great Federation, for although the North was beginning to feel its growing industrial power and was ready to assert it, the real Southerner in the real South never believed for a moment that such assertion would ever amount to anything. Charleston was the crown jewel of the South. All through her long history of nearly 300 years, she seems to have had a unique facility for surprising her visitors. "Behold, the half was not told me," is a common summing up of the matter even today. Beautiful for situation on a narrow strip of land between the Ashley and the Cooper Rivers, really arms of the sea, the town, like New York, runs south and north. A vivid picture at all times, especially in the sunlight of primitive color. Blue and green and dazzling white, with a nearer view of endless shipping stretching up to the skyline. Josiah Quincy, sailing up the Ashley River from Boston in the early 30s, had been much impressed with the beauty of the town as it was approached from the sea, declaring that it was, in many respects, magnificent. Later on, of the town itself, he declared that in its buildings, commerce, and shipping, and indeed in everything, it far surpasses all I ever saw or expect to see in America. In the 1840s, ships came to Charleston from the ends of the earth, but mostly from the West Indies, and bananas, coconuts, coffee bags, cotton bales, and bags of rice, especially bags of rice, the staple product of the immediate hinterland, were everywhere. And in and out of it all, through the warp and the weft of the Harlequin pattern, is the slave. Not at all the despairing, downtrodden person the word conjures up. "The Negroes," declared an amazed traveler from the North about this time, "notwithstanding their degraded condition, looked bright and happy." In the matter of slaves, as in almost everything else, the Charleston of the 1840s was at its best. Abolitionism, as urged in Boston, reached the Carolinas as a disturbing echo, but it is doubtful if the sound of it ever reached the stable or the kitchen or the field with any very telling effect. The institution of the South was working with ever greater smoothness. Slaves were well cared for, and especially with the wealthy planters or merchants, each generation had found the family bond connecting master and servant stronger and less galling. The slaves, particularly the house servants, the grooms, and the inevitable jockeys, took a tremendous pride in their families, while, as to the families, "my servants next to my children" was the creed of the master and mistress. Anything less would have been impossible. It was a fascinating community, the like of which had never appeared before or since. Unlike New England, which was largely colonized by yeomen, the Carolinas drew their first settlers from the upper classes. The Lord's proprietors, who obtained their amazing charter to a new empire from Charles II, reckoned among their numbers Lord Clarendon, the historian, the Duke of Albemarle, who, as General Monk, had brought back the king, Charles II, from exile to enjoy his own again, Sir Anthony Ashley Cooper, Lord Ashley, afterwards Earl of Shaftesbury, Lord Craven, Lord Berkeley, Sir George Carteret, Sir John Colleton, and Sir William Berkeley, all cavaliers of the most worthy standing. And Charles, with, it is to be imagined, no little relief, took this way of rewarding their services. He was, moreover, as he declares in his patent, more especially moved to do so by reason of the fact that the Lord's proprietors were incited by a laudable and pious design of propagating the Christian religion. By their charter from the king, which granted them all the territory now comprised in North and South Carolina and Georgia, with an unlimited western expansion to the South Seas, whatever that might mean, they were enjoined to establish the Church of England, but permitted to grant liberty of conscience. They might make laws, but only with the consent of the greater part of the people, a most unusual provision in those days, and they were required to establish a nobility, but not to give its members English titles. The new territory and its people were forever to remain of His Majesty's allegiance. The provision as to the founding of a nobility was what gave the Carolinas, and indeed the Old South generally, that distinctive quality which at every turn in its history has marked it off abruptly from the foundationally democratic North. For although the new nobility was little more than plutocracy, depending upon the amount of land owned by a man, the titles passed by descent as well as by purchase, and gave to the holder a standing distinctly above his fellows. The owner of 12,000 acres was a baron, of 24,000 acres a cacique, and of 48,000 acres a landgrave. For some reason, while no one was ever called baron or cacique, the title landgrave survived. And Landgrave Morton and Landgrave Smith are among the outstanding figures in Charleston history. It might be difficult to define the exact status of this untitled class of landed gentry, but it was perfectly well understood and accepted during the colonial period, survived the Revolution, curiously enough, with even added distinction, and was perhaps the most influential element in Charleston society down to the Civil War. The rule of this little oligarchy of rice and cotton planters in the 1840s was undisputed. That was their unquestioned privilege. The large trade of the town was left almost entirely to foreigners. Englishmen and Scotsmen especially came there, engaged in trade, and accumulated great wealth. And the landed gentry were content that it should be so, so long as they and their traditions represented Charleston before the world. The picture presented was an extraordinarily gracious one, at least on the surface. The planters ruled well and generously. They were men of culture and refinement. Most of them had been educated in England. They were travelers, readers, and often scholars. And they had a standard of honor so high as to keep the plain man in a state of breathless expectancy. A man's word must be better than his bond, because it had no guarantee. A woman's name and a promise, however foolish, were sacred. If one man wronged another, he must be willing, if necessary, to give his life in expiation, and he must always be ready to fight for his state or his lady. It was into this new world, so strange and unaccustomed to the New England concept of almost everything, that George Glover introduced his young wife when they stepped off the packet at Charleston. It was all familiar enough to George. Charleston was famous for its hospitality to strangers, especially strangers from the North if they came well accredited. And George had evidently done well and made good use of his opportunities in the 5 years he had been there. He had been given an honorary position on the staff of the governor of the state, enjoyed the title of major, and was generally called colonel. To be sure, colonels in South Carolina were almost as frequently met with as they were in Kentucky. Nevertheless, when a man attained to the title, whether he had a right to it or not, it showed quite definitely that he had been accepted. To be on the governor's staff, even in an honorary capacity, was to be in the midst of everything. Governors at that time in South Carolina almost had to be landgraves, in other words, landowners on a very large scale. And so, leaders in the class that ruled Charleston and prided itself in its culture. Colonel Glover, moreover, was a Mason, and the Masonic Order in Charleston comprised some of Charleston's most prominent men. The fact that the young couple arrived in the Queen City in the new year was a fortunate thing, for Mary, certainly, for it gave her time to find herself a little before the rush of the season began. Charleston was quite regular in this regard. As soon as the first frost had fallen in November, it was supposed to kill the malaria, the family departed for the country, and from November to the end of January, everyone who was anyone was on the plantation. By the end of January, the gay season brought the young people back to town, and the round of concerts, dances, races, and theater goings was soon in full swing. The old theater on Meeting Street was the scene of many grand assemblies. The stock companies were uniformly good, and stars came frequently. Fanny Elsler danced there. Jenny Lind sang. And Rachel acted Adrian Lecouvreur, while a little further down the street in the large hall of the Apprentices' Library, Thackeray lectured on literature, Agassiz on zoology, and Macready read Hamlet to an enthralled audience. While over and above and beyond it all were the race meetings, with their exuberant Negro jockeys in their exuberant jackets, their gay crowds, and the long procession of round-bodied coaches, all resplendent with hammer cloth and bands. On the box, a coachman radiating grandeur. Behind, a footman radiating alertness. And within and alongside on horseback, all the beauty and gallantry of the ages. It is difficult to imagine a greater contrast than that presented by Sanbunton Bridge and Charleston. But Mary seems to have grasped it all quickly enough. Very little is known of their story during the scant 6 months they lived in Charleston or in Wilmington, North Carolina, where Colonel Glover often went on business. That they were very happy, blissfully happy at times, is clear enough from such allusions as Mrs. Eddy made to those times in later life, and from some of her earlier poems. But no record as to where exactly they lived and how, what was the manner of their household, and how Mary passed her time while her husband was away at work, is preserved. From such material, however, as is available, not a little can be gathered. Thus it was not long before Mary was appearing in print, and in such a way as to show that she and her young husband were taking a keen interest in politics, always a grand question in Charleston. The bitter campaign between the Democrat, Martin Van Buren, and the Whig, or Republican, Henry Clay, for the presidency, had already begun. And Mary, true to the Democratic principles of her father and Albert and Franklin Pierce, was eager in her support of Van Buren and her opposition to Clay. Her few weeks in Charleston, as will be seen, had greatly intensified her native horror of slavery. But with her at that time, as with all but wholehearted abolitionists, the question was one of states' rights against federal rights. Slavery should be abolished, but it should be abolished in such a way as to preserve unimpaired the right of each state to self-government, on the terms provided for in the Constitution. Van Buren was the champion of the old democratic principle of states' rights. Clay was all for increasing the power of the federal government. Mary had been born and bred a Democrat, and so she sided with Van Buren against Clay. If I e'er consent to be married, and I am not quite sure that I may, the lad that I give my fair hand to must stand by the patriot Clay. He must toil in the great undertaking, be instant by night and by day, contend with the demon of party, and vote for the patriot Clay. So did a Clay partisan burst into print in Wilmington towards the end of March 1843. To which Mary promptly replied, "Oh, plight not your troth to be married, and don not the bridal array, for your lad's at a banner frolic, if he stands by the demagogue Clay. If he tug in a blind undertaking to stand by your side soon as may, be content to live single, my fair one. He'll stand by the demagogue Clay." There were many more verses to both original and parody than are here given, and deprived of an atmosphere impossible to recapture. Both seem sorry stuff, but they leave no doubt as to the writer's views and show clearly enough that Mary was at least keeping abreast of the times. On the larger issue of slavery, Mary's attitude was much more important. In her support of Van Buren and her opposition to Clay, her point of view is typically inherited. Gilbert's wisdom fitted her case exactly. "Every little boy or gal born into this world alive is either a little liberal or a little conservative. In her attitude on slavery, she not only ran counter to her family traditions, but also to the burning convictions of practically all her friends in her new home. Abolitionism in South Carolina, when Mary Glover was there, was not only political heresy, but something very like treason. There can be no question as to Mary's feelings on the matter, but it says much either for her own clear judgment or for Colonel Glover's wise influence that she did not launch out into some indiscretion in the way of an open attack on the institution. Such an attack would, of course, have been worse than useless and would have endangered her husband's position, if not ruined it. That she did raise the question in print under an assumed name seems certain, but she was careful not to disclose her identity. In her own home, she was quite definite about it. She had heard a lot about slaves, but actually to see them and talk to them, and worse still, have them wait on her, was a new and almost incredible experience. She apparently lost no time in trying to persuade George to set such slaves as he had at liberty. He may, from time to time, have had quite a number, as they were constantly offered in payment of debts, and were, in fact, conventionally legal tender. George had to explain, as best he could, that under the laws of South Carolina, there was no way by which a slave could be legally freed, and that just to turn them out would be like turning out a dog or a horse and leaving them to fend for themselves. They would simply be homeless, and that would be all. It was a hard problem. But meanwhile, there were many things to do. Above all, there was her husband's work. The cathedral in Haiti was an ambitious undertaking, perhaps too ambitious. But to a young girl of Mary's temperament, it was full of wonderful possibilities, not the least of which was the prospect of a trip to the West Indies. That Colonel Glover at one time seriously thought that such a trip might be necessary is made clear by one of Mary's poems still preserved, entitled, When Expecting to Leave for the West Indies. It is no more than the usual fond farewells to her family, to her father and mother, her brother and sisters. But it draws aside the curtain on many discussions between the two on how the great enterprise was faring and what it might be necessary for them to do. Then there was for Mary the wonder of the southern spring. All things unfolding, fresh and green, and the air fragrant with jessamine and dogwood and magnolia. Mary reveled in it, as is shown in perhaps the happiest of these early verses of hers, a poem, written at the Sound in Wilmington, in which she tells how much she loves it all and how eagerly she is looking forward to yet other unfoldments of rapture. As a background to the picture were her letters, those she wrote and those she received. Of those she wrote, practically none has been preserved. But her mother, in one of her letters already quoted from, speaks of how much she rejoices to hear from you so often. Mary was always a good correspondent, and some of the news she sent home may be gathered from references to it in the replies she received. Thus, Mrs. Eddy, in later life, used to tell of how Colonel Glover at one time had a quarrel with a quick-tempered Southerner over the question of slavery. The quarrel resulted in a challenge to a duel, and Glover, as the challenged party, had the choice of weapons. He chose toe-to-toe and muzzle-in-the-mouth. As such terms placed the indomitable courage of both parties beyond question, a reconciliation was quickly effected and honor was satisfied. It is probably to this incident that Mrs. Baker refers in one of her letters to Mary when she says, "Please give much love to your dear George, to tell him from his affectionate mother that to err is human, to forgive divine, and I know his own goodness tells him it is better to forgive an injury than revenge it." Mark, too, wrote at least once, the same Mark, only worse. Mary had evidently written home about the unhealthiness of the climate in the approaching summer. And Mark, under date of February 6, 1844, takes up a foreboding pen to expatiate on reward and penalty, on duty and esteem, softening enough before closing to say concernedly, "If it should be quite that unhealthy clime, and come to a better, it would be pleasing to me." One more letter, and then this back-and-forth picture, now of the old home at Sandbutton, and now of Mary radiantly looking forward to the future in her new home in the South, is complete. It is from Mahala Sanborn, the local blacksmith's daughter, who had been a kind of upper servant in the Baker household for many years. A complacent, gossipy letter such as Mary would no doubt rejoice to receive. "To dear, dear Mary," Mahala writes, "shall I this pleasant morning devote a few moments in conversing with my dear and old friend M. And how do you do? Would that I could shake hands with you and kiss your cheek this morning." And then she goes on to tell how she had just spent 3 weeks nursing at Mrs. Holmes, how Mrs. Ack is very sick, and how sad it will be for the children left in a cold-hearted world alone if she should not recover, adding that Mary knows well how to pity them. "Your mother and I have been very busy this spring, a cleaning house and quilting. We go into the clock room together and exclaim, 'Oh, that the girls were here today! What a good time we would have!' My love to Mr. G, and a kiss for yourself. Goodbye, farewell. Do write soon, won't you, Mary? From your true friend, M. Sanb." So it went through the spring and on into the summer. And then suddenly it all came to an end. Summer in those days in the lowlands of the South was considered almost deadly for white people. And as soon as the streams and ponds began to look green and filmy, the women folk were hurried off the plantations to the coast, and the men followed as quickly as the work would permit. The clearing of the forests and the embanking of the rivers and the flooding of the lowlands had added greatly to the fever of the country, as malaria was called, and the exodus from the plantation in the summer often began early in May. It was early in June that George and Mary set out from Charleston on what was to be their last trip together. The material for the cathedral in Haiti, which had taken so many trips hither and yon to collect, was at last being assembled on the dockside at Wilmington, and George had to go there to attend to the final loadings. A day or two after their arrival, George was stricken with a fever, and 12 days later he died. Mary was carrying a 7-month child, but as she was to write her brother George Sullivan later, "Day and night I watched along by the couch of death. She could only wait and pray. She prayed very hard, so hard that the good doctor was almost sure she was availing and told her so." George died, but if the testimony of the Reverend Albert Case, who was with him in his last moments, is to be accepted, Mary's prayers availed at least to the extent of making his passage easy and peaceful. "Conscious that the time of his departure was at hand," wrote Mr. Case in the Masonic Magazine, "he calmly arranged his business, prepared for the removal of her he loved to the home of her youth, and consoled her with the thought that they would meet again in heaven. Said he, 'I have a precious hope in the merits of my Savior.'" Behind the stilted language of a rather stilted age, the good intent is clear enough. George Glover was buried at Wilmington with full Masonic honors, the local lodge sending out a general invitation to the funeral. Quote, "The citizens of Wilmington are respectfully invited to attend the funeral of Major George W. Glover, deceased, at 6 o'clock p.m. from Hanover House to the usual place of interment, June 28th. End quote. The funeral was attended by the governor of the state and his staff, who walked in the procession with other citizens and friends from the Masonic Lodge to Hanover House and thence to the churchyard of St. John's Church. There he was buried, and Mary turned over the page on to another chapter of her long life. A chapter opening not too auspiciously, for despite her late husband's sometime prosperity, his passing found him in indigent circumstances, as the Masonic record of St. John's Lodge No. 1 in Charleston establishes. It is said on fairly reliable authority that his earnings had gone for lumber to be used in the projected cathedral at Haiti, and that during his illness was stolen from the docks. One of lesser character than Mary Baker would have been crushed for all time, but this frail woman in a day of frail womanhood was to rise again and again triumphantly above what surely appeared to be malevolent circumstances under which men would reel.